You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network with your host, Dan Gould. Virginia History with Rick Britton starts right now. Rick Britton is a local award-winning author, cartographer, and historian. You can find him online at rickbritton.com. He joins me in studio for our continuing series on Virginia's colorful 18th and 19th century history. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
And we want to put out a plea for folks to subscribe. After all, it is free. What are the advantages of people subscribing to these podcasts?
Well, the biggest advantage is that you won't miss a single episode.
So what happens when, what would they receive for free in their in-mail box?
They receive a very nice looking email that has the text portion of the post, reminding them of what the topic is going to be.
What the topic is.
For that day.
Right.
And then there's a link where they can either download that episode if they want to save it.
Right.
Or they can click on the link and go right to the site and just play it immediately from the website like they would normally.
And it's absolutely free.
And it is free. And I'm glad you mentioned that, Rick, because it is absolutely free.
It is free. And there's a way that they can give us feedback, too, outside of the podcast mechanism, right?
That's right, indeed. That's that they can email us at Rick Britton Podcasts. That's Rick Britton, B-R-I-T-T-O-N, podcasts with an S on the end, at gmail.com.
Great. So listen, send us some feed mail. Yes, send them some feedback. Write us an email and subscribe and let us know in the feedback what you like, what you don't like, what you'd like for us to talk about. And we'll try to do that.
We will.
Yeah.
And we'll even field the occasional question. If you have a question about one of the things that we've talked about during the episode, need a little bit of a clarification on that, we can't promise that we will respond to every email we get, but we will sure try hard.
Absolutely. That'll be a lot of fun. So get in touch with us. We're kind of doing this and hoping to hear back from y'all out there. We know you're listening. We know you're out there listening, so get in touch with us. It'll be great.
Excellent. So my friend, what have you come to talk to us about today?
Well, you know, we wanted to mix this discussion of Virginia history up some more, and we're talking about the Civil War in this series. And one thing that's not talked about a lot, and I find pretty fascinating, is the blockade and blockade runners. So people don't understand how this worked. The federal blockade began, the federal blockade of the Confederate coast, and we'll talk about the distance of that coast and what all that entailed. I think it's a lot bigger than people generally imagine. It began with the Anaconda Plan, and the Anaconda Plan was promoted by the first man who was the commander of all the Union armies at the beginning of the war, and that's Winfield Scott. Winfield Scott, believe it or not, an actual veteran of the War of 1812. To give you an idea of how old this man was in 1860, he was huge. He was pretty good. I mean, after all, he had directed the invasion of Mexico in 1848 that ended the Mexican War with a smaller army. He, as I mentioned, a veteran of the War of 1812, was huge, couldn't get on a horse by himself, needed a special platform, was famous for his huge meals where at the end he could eat an entire watermelon by himself. The man was huge. The man was pretty smart also, and he came up with the Anaconda Plan. And here's the idea. Okay, the Confederacy wants to establish its a separate nation. The Mississippi kind of cuts the Confederacy in two. So the Anaconda Plan strangles the Confederacy like the Anaconda snake by taking over control of the Mississippi, so separating the trans-Mississippi states of the Confederacy from the rest, isolating them from the rest of the Confederacy, and then puts a blockade on the entire Confederate coast and eventually just strangles, cuts off the Confederacy from the rest of the world, and strangles it. How large is that Confederate coastline, you might ask? 3,500 miles.
Wow.
When you think of the coastline of Virginia, including the Virginia Eastern Shore. There are two counties of Virginia out there, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, all of Florida, extremely long coastline of Florida, then Alabama, Mississippi, and then that long coastline of Texas. 3,500 miles and 12 major southern ports.
And we have to remember that that's a lot farther in 1860 than it is today.
Oh, yeah, 3,500 miles.
I mean, that's like going across the ocean today. I mean, that's a long way.
Absolutely,
that's
it
a
is.
Lot of, that's
when,
a lot of coast.
When you think that your vessel, you know, a sailing vessel might be sailing at 16, 17 knots, it's going to take you quite a while to travel a distance of 3,500 miles. Eventually, and we'll talk a little bit more about this in a moment, but eventually the United States Navy patrolled that coastline with 500 ships. So Abraham Lincoln, President Lincoln, issued a proclamation on April 19th, 1861, establishing, quote unquote, a blockade of the ports in the Confederate States. Now, why did he do it this way? It's a matter of international law. By declaring a blockade, which is a matter of international maritime law, in a way, he granted the Confederacy. It's kind of interesting. It's a dual-edged sword. In a way, he granted the Confederacy belligerent status, because by saying that he had to blockade them, he meant that they are an enemy power, granting them belligerent status. A lot of people said, well, he could have just closed the ports, but it's a different technicality in maritime law. So he granted them technically semi-belligerent status, but he also, and this also gave the European powers the right to recognize the Confederacy as a nation. In 1861, the U.S. Navy had about 90 vessels, and only half of those, of the 90, only half of those, about 45, were actually afloat at the time. So just think about this. Lincoln is declaring a blockade of 3,500 miles and 12 major ports and dozens, as you can imagine, of other minor ports with only 45 vessels that are actually floating.
Wow.
So it sounds impossible.
It sure does.
But of course, what they did was they pressed into service everything that they could scrape together. So that by 1865, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, there were 500 vessels in the United States Navy, just on the blockade squadrons, four squadrons, two in the Atlantic, two Atlantic squadrons, and two Gulf squadrons in the Caribbean, and 24,000 officers and enlisted men just in the naval blockade. Now, one of the things that attracted these men to this service, and when you hear this, you can totally understand, was the fact that there was a prize court involved in this, which meant that any blockade runner that they captured, and we'll talk about the blockade runners next, anyone that they captured with the goods on board, they were seized and then sold in a prize court, and half of the monies from the sale of the vessel and all of that valuable merchandise on board, military equipment, ammunition, but also other things that were being run through the blockade, half of that money went to the captain and the crew of his ship. So all of a sudden, cha-ching, they're seeing dollar signs, and it puts them, gives them a lot more interest in being involved in the federal blockade.
Sounds like an early corporate incentive plan.
Absolutely.
For sure.
Absolutely. Let's get that, you know, everybody work real hard. We're going to capture it. We're going to chase that thing down. We're going to capture it. And half of it is going to belong to all of us. Great incentive, if you ask me.
Now, can you briefly, very briefly, describe the ships themselves?
Well, in the blockade squadron, it was every possible ship that you can imagine. So even vessels that had been working in rivers, of course, the regular vessels, the frigates of the United States Navy, although they're very few by comparison, things that had been commercial vessels, transport steamers, everything that you can imagine, even things that had been used as ferries, every kind of vessel imaginable was pressed into service for the United States blockade. And then, of course, all those shipbuilding places in Connecticut and Massachusetts, all of them went crazy building more vessels to be used in the Federal Navy. So it was a tremendous effort. And we'll talk about the success or the lack of success of it in just a moment. Let's talk about it now from the Confederate point of view. From the Confederate point of view, one of the ideas they had in the very beginning was, and I know everybody, all the listeners have heard this, was that cotton is king. Cotton was the most valuable export from the Confederacy. It was the most valuable export from the United States of America, period, North and South. And in particular, the Industrial Revolution had exploded with all of the mills in England. And the idea that the Confederate nation, the administration, the Jeff Davis administration had from the very beginning, the idea that they had was by holding back the cotton, eventually it would force England to recognize them as a nation and break through the blockade in order to get that cotton. Now, how did this work as a strategy? Actually, it didn't work at all. It turned out that cotton was not king. England did not run out of cotton as quickly as the Confederate nation thought it would. And then, as the supply of cotton got a little bit scarce in 1862, England, naturally, started looking around for other suppliers. Who was another major nation that was growing cotton? Was Egypt. And so they went into the Mediterranean instead of coming to the United States, brought the cotton out of Egypt, and those mills producing all that cloth out of England kept on working. Now, how did this affect the Confederacy? It was disastrous for the Confederacy during the Civil War. In fact, over the course of the war, 95% of the exports, the export of cotton from the Confederacy fell 95% from 10 million bales. And here you understand why they thought cotton was king. 10 million bales of cotton out of the Confederacy in the 3 years prior to the American Civil War. And that fell to the end of the blockade, only 500,000 bales of cotton. So you see, at the end of the blockade, cotton was still getting out, just not very much at all.
And of course, that maps to a corresponding loss of revenue, too.
A tremendous loss. Yeah. I mean, here we're talking about their biggest export.
Exactly.
And all of a sudden, it's gone. Pretty much. I mean, 95%. Imagine if that happened to the United States of America today. We would all be...
If the GDP dropped by 95%.
We'd be a third world nation.
It'd be over, yeah.
In like 2 weeks.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
Okay, now the typical blockade runner. Let's talk about the blockade runners. I've got a little description in a book. It's really short. I'm going to read it to you. The average blockade runner might be a paddle-wheeled steamer. So a steamer, it's running off of coal-powered engines. A paddle-wheeled steamer of some 400 tons. That was its cargo capacity. About 200 feet long with a 22-foot beam, a 10-foot draft. So it's very shallow. That means it goes very quickly. Engines of 250 horsepower, which was powerful back then, but nowadays would not be very powerful, would give her the high speed of 15 to 16 knots. So this is 16 knots just running off of the engines without the sails.
And for our non-maritime people, listeners, how fast is that in miles per hour?
You know, you have stumped me on
that. Oh, no.
There is a difference between nautical knots and miles per hour, and I'm embarrassed because I used to be in the Sea Scouts when I was a kid living in Connecticut, and we had to know that, and I have forgotten. So maybe we'll have to come back, and I'll look that up, and I'll come back and tell everybody. But the point is, thanks for asking that tough question. The point is, 15 or 16 knots was pretty fast, considering it's not even using the wind at all. Typically, they sat very low in the water. They'd be painted gray or even black. And what they would do is they would approach the blockade, the cordon of American U.S. vessels outside of the Confederate ports. They'd approach them and then time it so that their run through the blockade would come in the middle of the night. These things ran so quietly, most of them actually were built new in the shipyards in England, and a lot of them were owned by commercial interests in England. Actually, some commercial interests in the North actually owned and ran some blockade runners, bringing war material, isn't that crazy, into the Confederate states that they were fighting against. Some were actually officered and crewed by British officers and seamen. So these were very fast, of the most modern technology. The best ones were, of course, everything was used too, but the ones that were successful were the best ones built with the brand new technology in the best shipyards in England. Something that's kind of confusing about them is a lot of people think that have gotten the impression that these things were armed. They were not armed, and they did not fight back if they were caught, for the very simple reason that technically, under maritime law, if they fought back, if they fired back, they're considered pirates. Not commercial seamen, but pirates. A big difference. So all of a sudden, men captured, seamen captured, instead of being held as prisoners of war, could be hung for piracy. So there's a very big difference. To give you an idea of the profitability, naturally, most often they tried to bring in military weaponry, ammunition, cannon, guns, but also because things became scarce in the Confederacy, items became scarce, they also brought in some of the finest clothing for women, perfumes, corsets, these kinds of things that had become scarce, and the price had skyrocketed because of the inflation in the South, which made them very profitable. The average blockade runner, the business was so profitable that a ship captain or the owners could afford to lose the vessel on the third trip.
Wow.
In other words, two trips
would more than
take care of the vessel, pay off the crew and everybody. And of course, with these people, with the crews running these, they made a lot of money, as you can imagine, because the profits were just unbelievable. Now, a couple of the most famous blockade runners, of course, the most famous blockade runner is a fictitious guy by the name of Rhett Butler from Gone with the Wind. And he typifies the blockade runner from the point of view of the South. Arrogant, well-to-do, hated by the patriotic Southerners, because what is he doing? He's a profiteer. He's profiting off of the war. Here in Albemarle County, there was a very famous guy by the name of Benjamin Franklin Ficklin, who went out west before the Civil War, founded the Pony Express. When the war broke out, came east and ran three blockade runners out of Wilmington in North Carolina. He made enough cash money from running three ships that when Monticello was seized, Monticello, the home of Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of Independence, third president, when it was seized by the Confederacy as alien property and sold at auction in 1864, Benjamin Franklin Ficklin, the blockade running profiteer from Albemarle County, paid $80,000 in cash, Confederate currency, for Monticello.
Wow. Now that's an amazing story. Wow. But the question that I think any layperson might ask at this point is, if you want to move goods through the country, just why not just go overland? Why go through the naval, try and get through the naval blockade?
Well, because
when an overland route might...
Because all of the best routes overland, that's a great question, were being controlled by the Union armies. So on the land side, the Union armies were controlled, and the river fleets were in control of the best routes over land. And then the idea was to also strangle them from the sea.
Right.
And eventually there was an effect on the Confederacy. There's still an argument in scholarly circles over how effective the blockade was, because lately there have been studies where they've analyzed the manifests of the vessels coming through the blockade. And it turns out that even late in the war in 1865, foodstuffs and ammunition and materiel was coming through the blockade to the Confederacy. In fact, in the Appomattox retreat, a Confederate wagon train was captured by federal cavalry that contained desiccated soup, dried soup, in tin foil wrappers, basically cup of soup for the Confederacy that had been manufactured in France. And a whole wagon train of that stuff was captured in 1865. Obviously, it had run through the blockade.
Wow, that's an amazing, amazing story. Rick, as always, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll be back in 2 weeks with more of Virginia's colorful 18th and 19th century history. And before we go, it's rickbrittonpodcasts at gmail.com if you'd like to write to us and ask us a question or just tell us, give us some feedback on the series. Join us each second and fourth Sunday for Virginia History with Rick Britton. For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.